All right, let's get cranked back up here. According to the notes, who was the author of these five books that we're studying tonight? Probably Ezra. Evidence that he is a skilled... Yes, God, please, thank you. Evidence that Ezra is a skilled scribe. God depended on him to write these books. And there are some ties between Ezra and Nehemiah. In Nehemiah 2:8 and 2:18, Nehemiah... I would like to, in many ways, be in his shoes. Chapter 2, verse 8, the last sentence. The king granted these wishes to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. That would be an enviable position to be in, to have God's hand on you. It is. And if you think about the time that Israel and Judah was going through, They were in captivity. They had been disobedient, rebellious. And yet here is a man, and it says the good hand of God was upon him. In 2:8 and again in 2:20. So I answered them. He was getting some opposition in 2:20. The God of himself will prosper us. Therefore we as servants will arise and build. The certainty he had that God was working in his life, the God of heaven will prosper us. We will arise and build. What a position to be in. You go back and look in Ezra two times, chapter 1, verse 5, and chapter 7, verse 6. It says of Ezra also, good hand of God was upon him. Great position to be in. We are studying the 16th book of the Old Testament. And yet please realize, as far as history goes, we've gone from Genesis, creation, to Nehemiah now is the end, historically, of the Old Testament. Even though it's the 16th out of 39 books, it is compiling for us the end of the Old Testament, just before we go into 400 silent years, the intertestamental period. So, we've got another 23 books to go through. But they're going to go back now and be paralleling a lot of these things that are going on. So Nehemiah is the end. It ends about 430 B.C., just before God goes silent, as it were. And yet God is very actively speaking to Nehemiah here. Author and audience, we already talked about it, probably Ezra. God through Ezra to Israel and to us, the themes. First one showing they're rebuilding the walls. The temple had been rebuilt by Zerubbabel. Ezra came back and helped beef up, make it better, helped teach the priests, Levites, how to serve, and really got with the people as far as how to worship and such in the end of the book of Ezra. And yet, when we open the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah's brother comes back to visit him and tells him the condition of the city. There's no walls. The walls lie in ruin. The people are scattered throughout the city. And Nehemiah wasn't around when Jerusalem was in its great period of Solomon and the great kingdom and the walls that were so strong and the great city, the city of God, the place where God abided or lived or abode with the people. And here it is, the walls are torn down. His brother tells him about that, and he weeps. He asks God for forgiveness for his sins, for his brother's sins, for the nation's sins, and is broken. In the end of the first chapter, what's the very last words at the end of the first chapter? Anybody there? The last sentence of the first chapter.
In those days
I was the king's cupbearer. We have, so again with Ezra, we have a skilled scribe, Nehemiah, we have a cupbearer. Different backgrounds, different men, and yet God used them both. I've got to believe that Nehemiah was a man that was quick on his feet. He goes in to serve the king in chapter 2. He pours the glasses. The job of the cupbearer, I better drink this a few minutes before the king is going to drink it. If I keel over, the king's not going to drink it. You think people might want to poison the king? That would not be a good position to be in, and yet there he was. And another, it says, I had a sad face. Verse 2, chapter 2, verse 2, the king said to me, why is your face sad since you are not sick? This is nothing but sorrow of heart. I don't think I, as a cupbearer, I'd go in with a sad face. Hey, king, how you doing? Things great? This is wonderful wine. You try a glass. I had about 5 minutes ago. I'm still alive. Go ahead. I'm enjoying myself. Sad face. And the king noticed. So obviously he was a pleasant person before. The king noticed. And I say he is quick on his feet because verse 4, the king said to me, why are you sad? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Lord, I can't imagine it was any other prayer than help. One word. And then he presented to the king. I found out about my home city, the city of my fathers. It is in disrepair. And he laid out the entire plan. I want to go back. I want to rebuild the wall. And while you're at it, would you grant permission for me to have your authority behind me as I talk to the governors and people in authority back there? Can I get some timber from your forest and the end of verse 8, I already referred to it. And the king granted these requests to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So that's the start of the book of Nehemiah. I already said the theme was rebuilding the walls. The second major theme was the obedience of Nehemiah. As you walk through, you'll see time and time again Nehemiah responding to people, to opposition, in a way that glorifies God. At one point, he says, they asked him to come out and meet him on the plain and to have a meeting with him so that they could delay him. He says, I'm completing the great work. I can't leave. I need to focus here. He remained true to the calling of his work. God asked him to rebuild the walls, and he got busy with it. He got the people behind him. They cooperated. You go and look at chapter 3, and they talk about rebuilding the wall in name after name. So-and-so completed this section of wall. So-and-so took the section of wall across from their house in such-and-such a gate, and they completed that. So that second major theme, the third paragraph down there, says that obedience of Nehemiah. Nehemiah was the right man for the job. He was not a skilled scribe. He wasn't used to write these books, but he was used by God, even in the face of opposition, from outside forces, from inside forces, from trickery. You see there the outline halfway down your sheet, rebuilding the walls under Nehemiah, half the book. And then Ezra is a contemporary. So Ezra was able to take time to revive the people, mainly through the reading of the Word. Let's take a minute and look. In chapter 8, great, great portion. Chapter 8, all the people are gathered together in verse 1. Ezra stands and reads the book of the law of Moses. Verse 8. So they read distinctly from the book in the law of God, and they gave this sense and helped them to understand the reading. If you go back up the line before that, this list of people in verse 7. And the Levites helped the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place. And then it goes on to verse 8. They gave them the sense and helped them to understand the reading. So you can imagine Ezra standing up on a platform, and all the people are out here, probably several thousand. And he reads from the book of the law. They're all standing. They're quiet. And he reads. And some of them, what do you say? What, you know, so you just imagine these people then, these men spread out and said, this is the portion he read. And this is the sense of it. This is what it means. And you go over to verse chapter 9. And the people line up and they confess their sins. They heard the word of God. They confess their sins. So we see, and getting under that outline, the rebuilding of the walls, the revival of the people under Ezra, that chapters 8 through 10. And then Nehemiah comes back. He had gone back to visit the king for a little bit. I don't know if he was taking a vacation or what. But he came back, and some of the things weren't going well. If you look at chapters 11 through 13, one of the high priests, one of the priests had given one of Nehemiah's opposition a room in the temple. And Nehemiah kicked him out and said, let's clean this room back up and let's use it for what it's for. People were not treating the Sabbath the right way. People were coming in and selling things on the Sabbath. He straightened them out also. So you see, again, John alluded to the unhappy endings. There's just, the people confess and you think, oh, it's going to end happily ever after. And yet he comes back and there's ongoing problems. Key verses. Nehemiah 4:6, we built the wall. The entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. The wall was completed in 52 days. And this is after he rode around the walls when he first got there. In some areas, the wall was, there was trash spread out everywhere, and the walls were crumbling in such a way that you couldn't even get through there. But in 52 days, they were able to put together the walls. And then the other key verse, Nehemiah 6:16. It happened when all the enemies heard of it that the wall was completed. And all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by God. Connections to Christ in the gospel. Nehemiah portrays Christ and willingness to leave his high position in order to bring back about his work of restoration. We have Daniel's prophecy of 70 weeks that we will get into in the major prophets. It began the countdown, begins the countdown for the return of Messiah. And you can look over in Daniel 9 for that. Key truths for Christian leaders. If you look again at Nehemiah 8, you see the results of reading and explaining God's word. Central to any ministry. Stay in the Word. Nehemiah's intercessory prayers. The chapters are listed there. In chapter 4 and 5 deal with his leadership, his facing opposition, them working and praying and protecting.
What's intercessory mean?
Intercessory prayer. You owe $100.
Yep.
I step in and pay it. I interceded for you.
Okay.
Intercessory prayer is us on our knees. Guy has a need, and we get on our knees and we pray for that need. There you go. No, you're fine. Charles Spurgeon, in 1865, started a Christian magazine. He called it The Sword and the Trowel. Talking about the sword, combating sin and evil. The trowel, laboring for the Lord. Building and babbling are both a normal part of the growing Christian's life. And if you look, I shared Nehemiah with my Sunday school class Sunday, and they said, this is a different type of book. It is. It's fun history reading. It's not as depressing as Judges. It's fairly short. I'd encourage you to read it, because you'll go into it and you'll see the portion that he's talking about where the men had to carry swords, or they had to have their swords on while they're working. They had to be ready because the enemy said, "We're going to come in and we're going to take some of you out and we're going to slow the wall down." There was opposition. And again, Nehemiah, just a man obedient to God, all the way from telling the king what he wanted, making a bold request of the king, and being confident. The God of heaven prospers us. Therefore, we will rise and build. And then in chapter 6, verse 9, "Oh God, strengthen my hands." Opposition was coming, and he realized where his strength came from. "Oh God, strengthen my hands." And even in the last, I think it's chapter 7 and 8, two or three times he said, "Lord, you know what these bad guys have been doing? Remember their deeds, would you?" In a little bit of a negative, "They aren't doing the right thing for me, Lord. Remember them when it comes time for their judgment." All right. "Oh Lord, strengthen my hands." Remember, this is the end of the Old Testament history going on. After this part of history is done, there's 400 silent years before Christ comes. Ezra rebuilt the temple, ready for the king to come. Nehemiah rebuilt the walls, building, protecting the city, ready for the king to come back. Where's the king? And he waits 400 years before he's able to come. Questions? Anything you saw from your reading that struck you as you looked at Nehemiah? Thank you for letting me share.
Oh, what's the last three books in the Old Testament? Zephaniah, Malachi, Zechariah, right?
Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi.
Those three prophets, the last three books of the Old Testament, are contemporaries of Ezra and Nehemiah.
If you had this,
that helps you put those minor prophets, the end of the Old Testament, actual 37, 38, and 39th book of the Old Testament, fit as contemporaries with Ezra and Nehemiah.
Yeah, Pastor Dan made a great observation, very interesting, right? You get to this book of the Bible, to Nehemiah, and from a chronological standpoint, that's as far as the Old Testament goes. Even though you have all these books left in the Old Testament, Esther and then the five books of poetry and the five major prophets and the 12 minors, they're not moving us forward time-wise. They're going back and they're showing us what all else was happening during that time of the kings. Interesting. And this timeline is helpful in that it shows you the prophets who were contemporaries of the certain kings. Okay, it's not exact, it's not detailed, but it's helpful. Oh, yeah.
Centers in on this period.
Did you handwrite that, by the way?
No. Karen Davis, Our Lady did a Bible study on Nehemiah
some time ago.
Well, we do a lot of Karen Davis stuff.
Right. Yeah. So that's from her.
Karen Davis, and that timeline is one of her.
Nice.
So there's a second timeline over there if you didn't get it.
All right, Book of Esther. The evening goes fast, doesn't it? We only got 20 minutes left. Book of Esther. How many of you have ever studied the book of Esther in some detail? Ever studied that? I taught it here probably 2 years ago in Sunday school class. We went verse by verse. And I made use of a book that I would highly recommend to you. It may be difficult to get a hold of. It's at the bottom of your introduction there. A book by Carson named Confidence in God in Times of Danger. He does an amazing job. He's an extremely good writer. Does an amazing job of tracing the sovereign providence of God in protecting the Jews through everything that you see happening in Esther. And it's very edifying. Now, he writes in an older style, but it's very, very good. So Esther, let's just kind of walk through. It's preservation through God's providence, specifically preservation of the Jews through the providence of God. You know that there was this guy named Haman who is kind of like the Hitler of the Old Testament. You know, he wants to wipe out all Jews. That was his goal. And in your notes, this large paragraph here is very interesting because it traces the history of the dispute that comes up here, okay, in this story. But let's think through the story. Esther opens with the king's feast. King Ahasuerus has this major feast in which he's showing all of his officials and servants how rich he is, and he brings them in, and it's a 6-month show and tell. And for 6 months, he's showing and telling how rich he is, how much stuff he has. Obviously, he's puffed up with pride. And at one point, in order to show off his wife, lesson on leadership, I don't recommend doing that. You know, hey, honey, come in. I want to show you off to all the guys. Come on out in your best dress. And it says, verse 11, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold, he had servants go out to bring Queen Vashti before him wearing the royal crown. Go get her. Bring my wife out here. I want to show off, you know, how great my wife is. And she refused. I don't know what that looked like, but no. Something like that. She said no. Queen Vashti refused, verse 12, to come at the king's command. And he became very angry. So then there's this question about what do we do now? Because he has been probably humiliated. You know, he's there probably saying, okay, bring her out ready now. And they're all going, she's not coming. Now bring her out ready now. It's like the Von Trapp family singers, and the Von Trapp family singers never come out. Well, Queen Vashti never comes out there. And so he fumes and he brings together his counselors. And this one, Memucan, comes up with this brilliant idea. We have Memucan's counsel from verses 16 to the end of the chapter, chapter 1. And basically he says, you know what? This is not going to be good for us as a nation. Because other ladies are going to get the idea that they can just say no to their husbands. So why don't we kind of kick her out of her royal position and give her royal position to somebody else and teach them that all wives need to honor their husbands. And amazingly, the king says, good idea. Let's do that. So now they're going to have the first ever beauty pageant. The Miss America contest, only it's not America. You're going to have a beauty pageant. And they're going to bring in these young ladies and find out which of the young ladies pleases the king. And that lady is going to become the queen instead of Vashti. So what do you think are the qualifications necessary for this position? Beauty, right? Respect. So they go throughout the kingdom. If you look at verse 7 of chapter 2, Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. And the young woman was lovely and beautiful. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Obviously, it's not his own daughter. It's his niece. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something like that. Or cousin, I think, maybe. His uncle's daughter, so that would be his cousin. Yeah. Right? So this is his cousin. So, interestingly, she comes in and she becomes part of this pageant, so to speak. And if you look at verse 9, the young woman pleased him, obtained his favor. He readily gave beauty. This is the person who's in charge of all these ladies. And she finds favor pretty much in everyone's sight who matters. Everyone likes her. She's beautiful. And as Rick said, you know, apparently her demeanor is very good. She's also completely submissive to her cousin Mordecai, who says what? Whatever you do, don't tell him what? Don't tell him that you're a Jew. What do you think about that? What about as a leader? Is she a leader? Well, she's going to become one. What's she doing?
She's not telling the truth, or like kind of like when Joshua went to survey the land.
Okay.
And Rahab withheld information and hid them.
Okay.
But it was for righteousness' sake.
Okay. Okay.
So she's kind of in secret.
Right. So
not telling the truth.
And we could also wonder how much she knows about all that's happening at this point, because of course we don't know. There's no threat against the Jews at this point, right? There's just a sort of beauty contest. But what else is she doing? Very good. She's simply obeying. She was raised by this cousin of hers, Mordecai. And he tells her, don't tell them. And so, verse 10, Esther had not revealed her people or her family, for Mordecai had charged her not to. So, she's there. You get to... So, go ahead.
Obviously, there's... Since Haman has such hatred, although it was...
He doesn't yet, of course.
No, but it was directed at Mordecai.
Right.
But he just didn't want to go after Mordecai. He wanted to go after... So
right.
So, there was some sentiment of distrust or something of the Jews.
And you remember, this really is profound. The paragraph that's in your notes here, I'll just read it briefly. The historical background for the drama between Mordecai and Haman goes back 1,000 years when the Jews exited from Egypt. It goes back to the Exodus, right? When they came out of the Exodus, they were attacked by the Amalekites, whose lineage began with Amalek, son of Esau. And God had pronounced a curse on the Amalekites that called for total elimination of that group of people. The Amalekites were supposed to be eliminated, right? Well, Saul got orders. He's supposed to kill all of them, every single one of them. But he disobeyed, remember? He didn't hack Agag to pieces. Samuel comes, he hacks Agag to pieces. But there are descendants. And Haman is a descendant of that line of people that was supposed to be completely annihilated by God's order. And they weren't. And that guy now wants to completely annihilate the Jews. Very ironic, very interesting. Okay? So... You know, later in the story. We're not there yet. Let's finish this part. Look at chapter 2, verse 17. Chapter 2, 17. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, one of the things that this writer I mentioned to you before, Carson, one of the things that he does is talk about how God in his sovereign providence gives people the exact qualifications that they need to fulfill the plan he has for them. And he traces that through, and he talks about how God gave Moses what he needed to fulfill what God wanted him to do. And God gave Esther what she needed. And part of it was her beauty, and part of it was her attitude towards Mordecai. And he extends that by application to say, and I find this very encouraging, God is sovereign. He knows what he wants to do with you. He gives what you need to do what he wants you to do. Okay? And you need to wait upon the Lord. You need to trust in him. And you need to trust that he is going to use you for his purposes. And he's going to make use of your background and your abilities and your whatever. He makes use of all that. So he has a very good, very long couple pages on this providence of God. But he says even Esther's heart to submit to her cousin is part of what helps out here. And then he goes on to say, how could Mordecai ever allow or condone her marrying this king? And he goes on to say that it seems that Mordecai must have been somewhat ignorant of God's views on this, because he's trying to, he deals with the issue of how can you have where Mordecai is condoning that Esther is going to be united with a pagan king. And that's not according to the law. Many warnings against intermarriage, right? So he says, even your ignorance God can use for his purposes. He just says that he thinks that he must not have known, or else he was weak. He said, whatever it is, whatever you come up with, God is using even that to bring about the plans that he wants. So even if you say, well, I have lots of weaknesses, God can use those to bring about what he wants. All right, so you get to chapter 3 and Haman's conspiracy against all the Jews. You remember Mordecai wouldn't bow down or pay homage to Haman. He gets so angry and he just can't stand this. Verse 5 says his heart was filled with wrath. And then he thought he's going to destroy all the Jews. Verse 6, he presents his plan to Ahasuerus crazily. Ahasuerus says that's fine, and so thus is born the plan to destroy, verse 13 of chapter 3, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, young and old, children, little children, and women, all in one day. Well, of course, Mordecai in chapter 4 basically says, he gets a message to Esther that she needs to step in. Okay? She needs to step in. And initially, Esther does not agree. If you look at, let's see, chapter 4, verse 11. Verse 10 says, Esther spoke to Hathach and gave a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called has but one law. Put all to death except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So if I just walk in there and he doesn't extend the scepter, guess what? I die. You're asking me to completely risk my neck. And there probably was a history that I don't know what percentage of them walk in uninvited and lose their head, but probably some did. So Mordecai's answer is a highlight of the book, and then so is Esther's answer to him. Verse 12, so they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place." Stop. Lesson for leadership. God doesn't need you. God isn't dependent upon you. You're not so crucial that without you, this whole thing falls apart. Don't ever think that you are so important that without you, God's just not going to be able to fulfill his plan. That is not true. So Mordecai lets her know that, hey, you're in an important position, but God isn't depending on you. That's kind of the sovereignty of God's side. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish, and yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Okay, maybe this is going to mean risking your life, but who knows whether or not the entire reason that God has you on the planet is for right now, is for this. That's an interesting thought for leadership too. You know, I remember when I was asked if I would consider going to Russia, and I was like, no. It's too cold over there, and I'm green, and I'm wet behind the ears, and I don't know anything, and da-da-da-da. And Alexei Kolomitsev, who now pastors a church in Oregon, well, right over the border in Washington, in Battleground, Washington, said to me something like, well, who knows, John, you're the one that's being invited. Well, that is true. I was the one who was being invited. And so, who knows? So keep that in mind. So, as you know, her response, verse 16 of chapter 4, go gather all the Jews present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. I recommend to you, there's a great commentary entitled, If I Perish, I Perish. It's a commentary on this book, very brief, short little book. Very well written. I can't remember the author, but you can find it. Commentary on Esther, If I Perish, I Perish. So she shows great wisdom and shrewdness in kind of setting up a banquet, and then she puts it off, and then I think she puts it off again. Haman thinks this is all about him. Finally, she reveals to the king Haman's plot. And you remember that Haman had built a gallows for Mordecai. And strangely enough, Mordecai hangs on the gallows that he had built for Mordecai. And the king planned to exalt a man in the kingdom. Haman certainly thought it was him. Instead, it was Mordecai. He asked Haman, what should the king do for the man he wants to exalt? And Haman says, who could that be but me? I know what you ought to do for the man you want to exalt. And he lays out all that he wants done for that man. And then he says, great, go get Mordecai, because that's the guy I want you to have ride on a big horse through the city and so forth. And there are proverbs that show that kind of sum up in proverbial form these lessons, these ironic twists. And it just shows that God is sovereign. God in his sovereign providence is bringing about his end. All right. The story goes on from there. They establish the great day of joy and gladness because they are given the ability to resist and to put to death any who are going to try to kill the Jews. They establish the day of Purim or Purim, which is celebrated to this day, one of the great feasts among the Jews. And I have at the bottom of your notes there, key truths for Christian leaders. God will do his work with or without you, but who knows? That's what I just went over. You will not prevail against a person of Jewish descent. That's when Haman comes home and he tells this whole story about he's so upset with Mordecai. And they go, oh, wait a second. Is this a Jew that you're after? Oh, you're dead. And you wonder, where would they get that? Where they got that is, they know there's a God in heaven who is for the Jews. If you're a spiritual leader, you're not going to be against the Jews, by the way. And then God providentially provides the persons needed for his work, including the gifts and abilities. Any questions on Esther? What should we do with Pastor Rick since he missed the quiz? What should we... I'm just kidding. We had a fun pop quiz tonight. We'll give you a copy of that. All right. Well, thanks for being here. Praise the Lord. We got through it. I know it's fast every time, but this is a survey. Just getting the big picture. Oh, and we're going to sing. Awesome.